ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Sonia Perkins, Managing Director of the Perkins Fund, founder of Broadway Angels, and founder of Project Glimmer. Considered one of the best performing and most senior professionals in venture capital, she invests broadly in all stages and areas of information technology, including internet, mobile, security, data, communications, consumer, and software. Sonia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with a little bit of background on your career. You're considered a veteran in venture capital, beginning your career in 1989 as an investment analyst. Can you share with me sort of the Cliff Notes version of how you got to where you are today?
Sure. A lot of it started early on in life where I was a student at the University of Virginia, and my parents were very generous and paid for my room and board and my tuition, but they didn't pay for clothes and all the extra things that I wanted to do. So I got some jobs throughout my career at UVA, and I worked as a troubleshooter in the computer lab. I was a programmer for the Department of Neurosurgery, and I taught Lotus to business professionals.
Wow.
And all of those jobs were cutting edge PC jobs. Little did I know it, but they paid $8 an hour instead of $4 an hour at the gym. And when I went to look for a job, I wanted to get into venture capital. I'd gone to the McIntyre School of Commerce and was lucky enough to have a professor that really loved to teach about entrepreneurship, which really wasn't taught that much in those days. And I wanted to be a venture capitalist, and I met with a firm in Boston called TA Associates, and they hired me. And it was almost like I was the first summer intern at Facebook, right? Everybody wanted to hire that person because they understood social media, because nobody really understood much about it. And there was very few PC software companies and networking companies that were being funded at the time. And it was kind of a boom where there were only 40 million PCs in the world at the time. And so they hired me to figure out the PC industry. And that's what I did. And I was very fortunate to find some really great companies. And I did a ton of research. And this, of course, was without the internet. You know, I was going to business libraries and reading magazines. And I ended up funding three companies that all went public. The first one I know everyone has heard of, called McAfee Associates. And then the other two were Artisoft and OnTrack Data Systems. And so I had very great beginner's luck in the industry. I had a proven track record at the age of 24 years old. And then I went to Harvard Business School, and I worked for Symantec, which was a wonderful company in the PC space, which now is very well known for security, and ended up joining Menlo Ventures in 1994, right when the internet was taking off. And again, you know, had some great successes early on with Menlo due to the advent of the internet. And so that's kind of how I did it. I started out without an engineering degree. I started out without any operational experience. And it turns out you cannot have those two things and yet be a really good venture capitalist. And so I always like to point that out, because I think that, you know, there could be all kinds of backgrounds for venture capitalists, not just the stereotypical engineer who was a CEO at a big company.
Wow, it's so impressive. And timing is everything. I mean, I also think it's interesting that you had these lab and programmer jobs. Was, especially because we think a lot about trying to get women into STEM, was it unusual, or were there other women in the roles as well? I mean, was that a difference?
That's a good question. It wasn't unusual to me, but I don't know how unusual it was to the outside world. Can I say that? They seem like really logical jobs. I went to the McIntyre School of Commerce, and one of my professors there asked me if I would help him with this class. So it was all new, but I don't think it was stereotypical male-female at the time.
Yeah, and that's sort of interesting. I think you probably would have noticed it if you were the only woman in the entire space, because it was so new. It's interesting to see how that...
Well, it is funny, though, back to the story of recognizing if you're the only woman. And when I first got my job at TA Associates, I didn't notice that I was the only business professional in the Boston office that was doing direct investing, doing deals. And I didn't notice that for about 3 months. And then one day I realized I was the only woman investment professional in the Boston office. And it was almost like I was standing on top of a tall building without any railings. And I thought, oh no, I'm the only woman. Did they hire me just because I was a woman? Did they hire me because they had a quota? You know, was I going to fit in? Did people think my business ideas were just as good, or was I going to have a tough time? And I literally moped around for about 3 days. And I literally told myself to just snap out of it and just stop thinking that way and not to look for discrimination and not to really focus on that. So I did notice that one time, and I realized that those thoughts were not aiding me in my career, and they definitely weren't helping me with my job. And so I just said, snap out of it. Just don't even think about it. Keep going.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I suppose it doesn't matter why you got there. It's you're there. So take advantage and move forward.
Well, it's funny. It reminds me of Tom Brady, the football player, right? So when Tom Brady in the Super Bowl, he wants to win the game, right? He wants to score touchdowns. He wants to get the most points, but he's not thinking about he's going to get tackled every time, right? He's just thinking about winning. And that's kind of how I looked at my career too.
That's fantastic. And I'm a Patriots fan, so I like that you use Tom Brady. So.
Yeah, I like Tom Brady too. Yeah.
Fantastic. So looking now at the VC space, what would you see happening in terms of sort of macro trends?
So what's hot, right? Yeah. Well, I mean, people are pretty excited about consumers, and they have been for the last, you know, 10 years or so, given the advent of the iPhone, right? It's having a very powerful computer in your pocket that you can access anywhere with wireless. So that's clearly expanded all the things that people can do when they're not at home. They can order things from anywhere. So consumer has been much, much bigger and more popular than ever in the history, I think, of the venture industry. Mm-hmm. I tend not to focus as much on consumer, although I do some consumer, but there are a lot of areas in technology, the core, hardcore tech, which is where I've really established myself with my track record, that are very interesting. So one area that I'm really liking is blockchain technology. So using blockchain to track goods in a supply chain, using the blockchain to track money, you know, all kinds of things. I think it's a really interesting area. And in every kind of new technology trend, what I tend to do is I like to back the infrastructure companies. So the companies that have the technology that everybody needs to buy in order for whatever the new trend is going to be. So, you know, when the internet was taking off, I invested in a company called F5, which was the leading load balancing company that every website company had to buy a load balancer. So I think the blockchain technology is very similar to that. So I'm very excited about that. And of course, I'm also interested in the cryptocurrencies, although I'm still trying to figure those out. But, you know, if you're a venture capitalist, you definitely want to have a play. So I've invested in actually a fund that invests in technologies around cryptocurrencies without having to pick them all. I've been looking at artificial intelligence, and related to that is machine learning. Mm-hmm. There's just lots of things. And then the other thing that's really interesting is these old categories like communications and security are also really important right now. So the internet is being used in ways that it was never intended to be used. So basically, the internet was established to be a self-healing network that would continue to work if some of the nodes went down. So if there was an attack on the United States of America, then if Washington, D.C. went down, that you could still communicate using the internet to other cities. And what it has become, and basically you had armed guards standing in front of buildings protecting the internet, and that was security. But what it's become is basically anything and everything connected to this network without a lot of the security features, things like not knowing where the traffic came from and things like that.
Right.
And so so security is still very, very big because, you know, the internet is being accessed by so many people in so many different what kinds of ways. But then also just the core infrastructure of the internet. So the routers haven't had a lot of significant technology upgrades in over 30 years, right? IP hasn't really changed that much in 30 years. And so I'm interested in companies that solve those kinds of problems too.
Oh, that's, you know, I haven't even thought of that. That's really fascinating. In terms of security and the internet, would blockchain fit into that piece as well? Does that offer some of that security because it's more transparent, or is that not related?
Well, it prevents a lot of fraud. So for example, I just invested in a company that uses private blockchain technology to track pharmaceuticals in the supply chain, right? Mm-hmm, and so so there's new regulations that have come out that require that the pharmaceutical to the package, not the pill, but the package has to be accounted for in every step of the supply chain. And so if you can have a secure database that you know does not allow any fraud to hold that information, then you know it's true and it's secure and it's solving big issues like fraudulent products, things like that. So if you can't find the pharmaceutical serial number in the secure blockchain database, then it's probably fraudulent, right? So things like that. So that helps a lot.
Right. When you're looking at AI and machine learning, how do you see that intersecting with entertainment? Or, you know, is that something I don't know if you've thought about it. I'm curious.
Well, I'm sure it will intersect with entertainment. I mean, part of it, for example, just the quality of the content, right? So if you want to have a show that's kid friendly or a show that's for a certain type of audience, instead of having the individual look at all the content of the show, why not train an algorithm to do it, right? I mean, you know, people talk about using AI to find, you know, funny cat pictures on the internet, things like that. So I think you could definitely use it for those kinds of things and determining what somebody wants to watch based on their prior habits and things like that. So I'm sure there's lots of overlapping, although I haven't really thought too much about it, but maybe that wasn't on my list of questions, but I'll think about it
right
later.
Yeah. I was just curious. It's also interesting when you think of AI, is that a frightening thing at all? I mean, different people have really wildly different feelings around AI. And if we think about the evolution and change over time of technology, that we're at this inflection point there. That it's exponentially changing and that the tech itself is exponentially changing and it will outstrip our ability to understand and manage it. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think this relates to diversity, believe it or not. I think it's important that you have diverse teams developing diverse products and, you know, diverse venture capitalists funding diverse teams. And and the reason why is that you want to have various scenario testing, right? You want different diverse point of views thinking about what will happen if this happens or what will happen if that happens. And I think, you know, sadly, Facebook is an example of where they didn't have enough diverse thinking on determining what might happen if the wrong kind of advertisers get the data, right? And they've paid a big price for that mistake of not realizing that maybe foreign governments could potentially hack, you know, U.S. elections, right? I mean, that's a big price to pay. And I think that has to do with diverse thinking. And I think with AI, a lot of things could potentially happen, like the fear that the intelligence will outwit the humans, right? And so the idea that you just have people thinking about scenarios of what could happen. And so it's just important to have a broad, diverse ideas around the table for that. But I do think in general that a lot of good can come from artificial intelligence when you think about looking at medical records or cancer diagnoses or just taking large, you know, big data is another category, but just taking large amounts of data and learning from it and getting results, I think, if done responsibly, I think that's really important.
It's interesting stuff. I mean, one of the things, you know, speaking of Facebook and the failure to sort of see what could go wrong, almost like looking at it sideways and seeing a gap. With, you know, all of this personal information, all of this sort of surveillance that constantly goes on and can be leveraged by AI to say wonderful things. I mean, I was talking to one person I interviewed, and they were saying how Google search actually is a better predictor of some cancers than some medical tests because of the volume of data they have been able to tie it back. I mean, it's fascinating. And yet, how do people feel about that? And where, if when you're investing in things, when you're looking at things, is it part of your role to think about that? Or is it really you're interested in diverse teams because they're going to make for robust products and success, because obviously you're investing to invest. But do you have other factors that go into it? And is that part of the thought process?
It's actually a great question. And in 2010, I kind of stepped back and I said, what am I doing? What is the essence of my investment program and life program? And I came up with a statement that I, you know, have on my Twitter bio. I have it on my webpage for the Perkins Fund. But what we do is invest in people and companies that matter. And so we want to invest, and I want to invest in companies that I think are moving the world forward and not moving us backwards and not hurting us. And so I think mm-hmm. about that all the time. And not to criticize, but I don't invest in game companies. I don't mm-hmm. think it's good for society to addict children to video games and apps, you know, various games. And many of the teams that build these games actually have that on their product map of how do we get this product to be so addictive that the kid or person is not going to want to turn it off. I don't think that's good for society. And I think we have seen with data that just saw in the news today that kids 18 to 22, who I kind of consider as the iPhone generation, where they grew up having an iPhone since childhood, those kids are unhappy. They're the loneliest children and people in any category, right? When you think you're at a time of your life when the future is ahead of you, but you've been unwittingly addicted to games or your phone or social media or things like that, and they're unhappy. And so that makes me really nervous. And so I don't want to invest in anything that I think will hurt or harm a child. And so I just don't do it.
That's fascinating. I mean, it's, I have a 17-year-old, and he once said to me, you know, I kind of wish that we didn't have phones. I know we have to have them, but it makes it harder to talk to people in real life, because when you're talking on a phone, you can be perfect. But also when you pick up a text, you don't know if it's the genuine reaction, the authentic reaction, or if they've crafted it. And I thought that was really sad, you know, and true.
Yeah, and even the developers of the iPhone, when you think about the product and the powerfulness of the product, I'm not sure how many people on the development team were thinking about children. Like, what do you do when you give a 2-year-old an iPhone? And sure, some of the apps are good for kids, but if a kid can't sit through a dinner or, you know, walk down the sidewalk without being on their iPhone, is that good for society? Is that good for the child? And who was thinking about that? And I think we really are facing some serious issues with iPhone addiction, which we probably should have thought about earlier. And in fact, you know, if Apple's listening right now, I would love a product that I could give to my daughter that just basically calls, researches school projects. The texting, I don't want her to text, because I see a lot of kids in her class that text and they're not, sometimes they're included in the group text, sometimes they're not, and it can be very isolating. And I just think that, I just don't think that's so good for kids.
Yeah, it is interesting. So at your fund, what do you look for in companies then, in entrepreneurs? So obviously you don't, it's do no wrong. Are there aspects about the entrepreneurs that sort of character things that you look for?
Absolutely. So I personally believe that entrepreneurs are born and not bred. So I am looking for an entrepreneur that would be an entrepreneur regardless of how cool it was in the world right now. So right now it's really cool to be an entrepreneur. And so it's really easy to start a company and, you know, for many people to find capital. But I want to invest in the entrepreneur that has this idea and it's just burning in his or her heart to just do it. I'm looking for an entrepreneur that has a really big problem that they want to solve for the world, and one who can get a group of people to believe in their vision to join their team. So a great ability to hire. So I'm looking for a big market, a passionate entrepreneur who can execute, and, you know, good teams around them.
How big, I mean, how far along is a company typically when you are investing in them? Are they startup?
It really depends. So in the olden days when I was working at TA Associates, you know, the companies had to be growing at 100% per year, be profitable, and have no venture capital already. So there were times when we invested in companies. I think McAfee at that stage, and they had over $5 million in revenue. There are other startups that I invest that it's just an idea. One example is Lynn Perkins, and she's the founder of Urban Sitter. And it turns out our children were in the same preschool program, and she invited me to lunch. And I was working so hard at the time; I had 10 boards and was commuting back and forth to Menlo Park. And I thought, I have to meet at least one of the mothers of my daughter's class. And I thought, I'm just the worst mom, right? And I had no idea why she wanted to meet with me. So we met, and she told me this idea about using social media, using Facebook, to book a babysitter. So you could just put your time in, like an open table reservation. You could read reviews about the babysitter on kind of like Yelp-like reviews about the babysitter, and now you can have a video. And you could see which ones of your Facebook friends actually used the babysitter or knew the babysitter. And I thought that was just the most fabulous idea, because it basically created what I call a trusted classified, where it was a classified ad that you could really trust, as opposed right. to just reading an ad on Craigslist and all of that. And so I was her first investor. I was the seed investor in that company. So it really is a broad range of stages.
When you're dealing with something where it is like a seed investment, where it is the idea, how involved are you in then helping to manage and grow that idea? How involved do you get, or do you just sort of let it go? What's the level of involvement?
It really depends on what the entrepreneur would like. I typically do not go on the board of a seed investment, and my dollars invested in tend to be smaller than, you know, a later stage company, because you don't have as much data. And so you want to put in some money just to see how it goes. And if the company goes well, you put more money in later. And so sometimes, you know, I'll be visiting with investors, you know, outside of the country, or, you know, helping with business pitches or introductions with other investors, or helping with business strategy or distribution, you know, things like that. And other times I won't hear from the entrepreneur for, you know, a while. So it really depends.
Interesting. I read that although the Perkins Fund doesn't invest only in women, over 50% of your fund founders are women, compared to the venture capital industry average of less than 5%. Presumably you're all looking at the same business goals. So why do you think this is the case?
Well, I think the venture industry does not have a very good track record of hiring women or funding women. The data is out there that only 7% of partners in venture capital funds and firms are women, and only 2% of the dollars that are invested out of the entire, you know, venture capital industry go towards women entrepreneurs. And there's all kinds of theories why, but my theory is you have a group of, you know, non-diverse people investing in more non-diverse people who fund more non-diverse companies. So I think that's it. I think it's like invest and like, right? And I think as a woman, I have a unique perspective, because I have seen many examples of successful men entrepreneurs, but I've also seen examples of successful women. And so I don't have an unconscious or conscious bias against women. And so, you know, it's easy for me to invest in the best ones. But I also think right. because I'm the founder of Broadway Angels and Project Glimmer, and there's so few women in the venture industry, that the best women entrepreneurs come to me. And so it's a real competitive advantage when you have a wonderful woman entrepreneur who'll say, gee, we really want to have the Perkins Fund in this, because, you know, Sonia is committed to investing in women entrepreneurs. So So I think it's both.
So there's an element of self-selection in that you get the cream of the crop presenting themselves to you. And also you're open to noticing their skills and capabilities. When you are looking at entrepreneurs, are there any noticeable differences, female versus male? You know, have you noticed anything different when people are coming in to pitch that women do or tend to do differently than men?
Yeah, so there are some differences, and I've seen enough companies present, and one has to do with, I don't know if it's women's nature or just not wanting to disappoint or something like that, but women tend to pitch what they're going to do. So they say, I'm going to get to this number of sales or this product by the end of the year. That's what they'll do. I think men tend to exaggerate a little bit more, which looks like they have a bigger vision, you know, that kind of thing. And so it ironically hurts women more than it probably should. And I use this example of a furniture store. So a male entrepreneur will come in and pitch a furniture store, and he'll say, I'm going to have couches and tables and headboards and coffee tables and dining sets and chandeliers, and that's going to be what I'm going to do. And it sounds like a really great vision. And then the woman will come in and she'll say, I'm going to make a coffee table. And by the end of the first year of operations, they both will have a coffee table.
I see.
Yeah. But the man has the bigger vision. So I think women need to just expand on their vision. Not expand on their vision, but expand on communicating their vision, because they all have the vision. They just don't want to disappoint, and they basically say what they're going to do. And I think men tend to be a little more optimistic about their performance.
That's interesting. In what ways do you think, have you found in your personal experience being a female VC, has it been, other than you bring to bear a different experience in that you can see and understand women, have you, being the only woman in the room, have you felt that? I mean, other than that one experience early in your career, have you felt different? Have you felt that it has affected you, how people treated you throughout your career?
It's hard to know what it's like to be a male venture capitalist. My only experience is being the only woman or one of the only women. But I think being a woman venture capitalist has been helpful to me for a couple of reasons. One, I'm just easily remembered, right? There's not very many women. And so of course, they're going to remember a woman venture capitalist. And then also, people tend to think that I'm smarter because there's so few women. And because there's so few women, if you are one of the few women, you probably are smarter. And so I've been given a lot of benefit of the doubt, I guess, on that one. But maybe I am smarter, right? I don't know.
Maybe you are. Don't sell yourself short.
So I get a lot of credibility. I will say that the entrepreneurs that I have worked with have just been fabulous. And, you know, one out of every three investments that the Perkins Fund has made is actually with a prior entrepreneur who I've already invested in the past. And I view that as my report card, right? Because people tend to only want to work with people who they want to work with. And I think it's because I have a relatively unique perspective. And in times, you know, here's a great example, in times when things are not going well, so let's say the company is running out of money, let's say we just lost an employee or, you know, something like that, I tend to not get too overly upset. You know, I'll ask the right questions and, you know, we'll ask, is this a product problem? Is this a market problem? Is this an implementation problem? Right? Because you can fix a product problem, you can fix an implementation problem, but you can't fix a market problem. So let's just kind of dig in and figure out why is it that this company isn't working as well, or why sales are slower, or things like that. And the CEOs greatly appreciate that kind of view versus causing blame or blaming others. And then the CEOs also appreciate clarity that I give them when I say, here are the three things you need to do to keep your job, because the board's job is to, you know, hire and fire the CEOs. And so they need to know what it is that is required. And I tend to be very simple. And I say, number one is you have to meet the numbers. It doesn't matter what the numbers are, as long as you gave me those numbers. And number two is you have to hire well. So you can't blame the VP of sales or the VP of engineering for screwing up because, you know, whatever, it's ultimately the CEO's responsibility. And then finally, you just have to have happy customers, right? Which implies that the product works, that you're getting paid for the product and things like that. I think a lot of times entrepreneurs can get confused because the board isn't very clear. And the feedback I've been given is, you know, it's great to be straightforward in a compassionate way. And then finally, when companies go out of business, where it just didn't work out, usually the market didn't work out, there really wasn't a market for the product. A lot of times I'll be the only person in the board meeting saying, gee, well, the company's going out of business, so let's focus on the customers and let's focus on the employees because we're all going to lose our money or part of our money. It's going to be a bad investment. So let's not worry about the financial decision because the decisions we're making when a company is going, you know, under really aren't financial decisions anymore. They're more decisions about character, the more decisions about helping others and more decisions about, you know, the future. And so I tend to, you know, be very generous with management teams when things are going south, or, you know, going bad, because I really want to save the jobs and save the customers. And employees are incredibly grateful, and, you know, customers are too, because they, you know, have taken a chance on an early stage company, and you really want to encourage that behavior going forward because there's going to be more startups, there's going to be more first customers needed for early stage companies. And I think that point of view is relatively unique in the venture industry. And I don't see a lot of people like me with that point of view in board meetings.
Well, it's really, that's so interesting. And I love also the clarity around what you need to do. I think that's such a wonderful, clear distillation of what you need to do. How has the industry responded to your work with female founders? And what would you say is your greatest success, like the one that you would hold up as, you know, this is the one that I'm just so proud of?
In terms of investments?
Yes.
My best success, and I have had a lot of successes, so it's not my
you
favorite.
You have had a lot of success.
Well, I've worked with a group of people for three companies in a row. Two founders, a gentleman named Andy Ori, and another one named Patrick Malampi. They founded a company called Priority Call Management in the early 90s. And it was a company that basically did enhanced services for telecommunications. So international callback, voicemail, one number, that kind of thing. And that company did well and got sold. And then they started the next one and they asked me to be involved. And that company was called Acme Packet. And Acme Packet had a product called a session border controller that enabled high quality voice over IP for phone switches. And so all the phone calls today are made over IP, which is the internet. And in the early days of IP phone calls, the quality was really bad. And Acme Packet was a company that ultimately fixed that problem and went public. I think its market cap at one point was around $7 billion. And, you know, obviously was a great investment for me. And then most recently, the founders a few years ago started another company called 128 Technologies. And that company is building software-based routers to fix a lot of the problems of the internet, to make it, you know, ready for state-of-the-art use and for use of all different kinds of devices, to make the traffic more efficient, to make the internet more secure, to, you know, solve a lot of these problems. And so, you know, this is our third time working together. And, you know, every time the market gets better, the product gets better, and the impact to the world gets bigger. And so I would say I'm probably most proud of that relationship. And I'm on the board of 128.
That's fantastic. What a great history. What a wonderful story. Jumping ahead, you had mentioned Broadway Angels, and this is your angel investment group made up of world-class investors and business executives who happen to be women, which I like how that is, how that description is put together. I read a Wall Street Journal article that your approach with this is a little bit different. because the group doesn't invest as a group. Can you describe how Broadway Angels works?
Sure. So I founded Broadway Angels in 2010, and I thought it would be fun to get a group of women investors together and, you know, look at deals together, share deals and due diligence, and show the world, as well as women and girls, that there are women venture capitalists, and these women are very good at their jobs, right? And at the time in 2010, and even times before that, people said there are no women in venture capital. You know, women may not be as qualified as men are in venture capital. And I just thought, well, that's crazy. And so we needed to get a group of role models together who were the best in the business that people would aspire to be like, and just look at deals together. And so it's not a fund. So many of us have our own funds or work for funds, and we share deals and due diligence. So one of us might be an expert. So 128 Technologies is a great example where I was an expert in the space and had the connections with the entrepreneurs. And so some of the Broadway Angels came in and invested in that company. There are other people in the group who, let's say, are really great at medical technology, and you know, they will share a deal, and people who, you know, admire their expertise can participate or not. So it's relatively unique, but I think it does give women a voice, and it shows the world that there's more than just a few women around. It's been really fun. I mean, one of the things that I really value about it is having friendships with purpose. And it's great to have your girlfriends, and it's great to hang out, which is great, but it's so much more fun to get together with your girlfriends and talk about blockchain, or at least for me, you know, or talk about, you know, what's happening with the IPO market, or, you know, issues with the Me Too movement, and how does that relate to, you know, our industry. So it's wonderful to have this group of women working together. You know, the one thing we didn't talk about was Project Glimmer, and I would love to be able to say something about that, if that's okay.
Oh, yes, please.
Well, I will always talk about Project Glimmer. So at the same time that I started Broadway Angels, I also started Project Glimmer, because there's all this talk about how there's not enough women in STEM, and there are not enough women, you know, pursuing careers in tech. And well, I believe that, you know, a girl doesn't build a self-esteem right after she goes to Stanford. A girl's self-esteem starts when she's younger, right? And in San Francisco, you know, the San Francisco's firefighters toy program had no gifts for teenage girls. And so there were all these girls in our community that were forgotten, that were 12 years old. And I believe that when a girl doesn't have anyone who believes in her, she's not going to believe in herself. And so I started Project Glimmer because I wanted girls to know that their community did care about them. And so our mission is to inspire at-risk teenage girls and women to believe in themselves by letting them know their community cares. And what we started out doing was giving jewelry and makeup to teens and women at important times of their lives, like holidays and Mother's Day and birthdays and graduations. And we have moved towards that. So last year we served over 105,000 girls across the United States. But then we've also moved to a program called Days of Empowerment, where we bring together foster girls and they come to a day of empowerment where they get their hair done and their makeup done and a professional headshot done that they can use for their LinkedIn page or resume. And we have resume writing workshops. And then at the end, we have a panel where we have formerly at-risk girls who have become successful at whatever it is that they do. And they talk about how they got there and how they became successful, because we believe at Project Glimmer that you can't be what you can't see. And so we want to give these foster girls as much inspiration and many role models to be something. And they've been so successful. We just did one in New York last week. We're doing one at Google next week, which is going to be amazing. And, you know, imagine having all these foster girls coming to see women from Google who've made it, right? And so anyway, I'm super
fantastic.
Excited about it. Yeah.
Well, that's great. I mean, what's really interesting and what I like about it is that you're looking at it broader that it's not just fantastic to encourage women to work in STEM, but it's also that that may not be what jazzes up a girl, and that's okay. And she can be appreciated and encouraged to be successful. That's really interesting. And
we believe when a girl believes in herself, she can change the world. And if she doesn't believe in herself, she can't do anything. And a lot of the beliefs that she has about herself when she's younger, she will carry with her through her adult life. And so we just want these girls to know that we really care about them.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been fascinating, and your career is remarkable and impressive. And I think you probably are the smartest person in the room. And I don't think people were.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say that.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Sonia Perkins. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.